This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. This is the place where government actions come face to face with business decisions at bgov.com and, of course, on the air at Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We've noticed a bit of a shift in production, albeit small, but it's happening. And I'm talking about production of natural gas and oil. We're kind of seeing some movement from offshore now to onshore, but there's a little bit of a catch. Onshore drilling and fracking is happening, and it's happening on land owned by the government that's leased back to companies that's doing the work. So the government owns the land. They're making money off of the companies that are coming in to drill for oil and the gas that we then consume on a regular basis. Where is it happening? What does it mean for the offshore industry? I know you're asking yourself that right now. Well, I've got a couple of people with answers. Economic analyst Jason Arvelo and energy analyst Rob Barnett join me now to discuss their latest piece, Leasing Rebounds, Onshore Production Up. Gentlemen, thank you for being here.
Great. Pleasure to be here.
So is this accurate to say that the government is now making a whole bunch of money off of companies coming in and drilling for oil and gas and such?
It is. And in the amount of about $2 billion in 2012, the government received from private companies for oil and gas development. It's critical to remember that it's the federal government's land, as you mentioned, that it's then leasing out to the private industry. But, you know, each year we're bringing in billions of dollars from that kind of business.
And to add to that, leasing is just a small piece of it. Really, royalties, once you actually are producing, generate a lot of revenue for the government. So for each amount of oil or gas produced, the companies pay a certain amount back to the government.
Nice.
And it, you know, the Department of Interior is actually one of the few agencies that is very positive in terms of revenue generation for the
pulling
government,
their
besides
own
the
weight.
IRS.
Well, besides, well, of course, but they're the agency of which we do not speak. At least I don't.
That's right. And so if you include the royalties that Rob was talking about, it's about $12 billion last year alone.
All right. So here's a question for you. Had we not experienced the disaster that BP did in the Gulf, is this a conversation we'd be having right now, or would we still be major, you know, for the most part, doing this offshore?
It's an ongoing activity. The government leases land that then private companies are able to generate. About 30% of all oil is generated from public lands. So despite or even without the BP disaster mm-hmm. happening, I think we're going to see, you know, federal land continue to be a major player in the energy market.
This is an irreplaceable fossil fuel, so to speak. Are there reserves onshore that are greater than those offshore? If we were to compare the two, which one has more, and how long could they sustain us? Let's say onshore for starters.
Well, the onshore resource is certainly easier to get. So companies like that. There's only a handful of companies that can go out in the ocean, drill in, you know, deep water conditions where you're, you know, facing, you know, just hurricanes and all kinds
sure.
of things, and continuing to operate. So, I mean, I think onshore is generally more accessible because that opens up the playing field a lot more for companies that participate in that market. But, you know, as Jason was just saying, I mean, this is really a nuts and bolts kind of thing. I mean, this has always been going on in the background. You know, in the U.S., the BP disaster sort of brought this
sure.
to the forefront, and now, you know, your average Joe kind of knows that we do a lot of this sort of thing. But, you know, onshore and offshore oil and gas production in the U.S. has been around for, you know, a century at this point.
I guess a testament to the fact that the offshore drilling is a lot more complicated, probably a lot more expensive than drilling onshore, even given the lease prices and the royalties
sure.
and such. You're probably making a little bit more off of the onshore
stuff.
A lot
more expensive and a lot more profitable, too. We
sure.
generate, for every barrel generated onshore, there's about 5 barrels generated offshore. So that's where the bulk of our federal oil comes from.
Okay. All right. Government owns a lot of land. How much land are we talking about here that they're actually utilizing for this purpose?
So it's millions of acres that are leased every year. The Bureau of Land Management manages about 500 million acres in the U.S., only a small portion of which are then leased out to the private industry.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Jason, but the U.S. government is the largest owner of land in the United States. They own more than any individual or any corporation.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about that.
well, most of it are parks that people use, and you know, it's
good point.
Think about taking your family to go hiking, things like that. You're usually doing that on a national park.
Didn't even think about that. You know, if you were to speak to Director of Research Bob Lighten about this, he would say that those parks are definitely ripe for sale at this point to help pay things back that the government may be lacking at this point.
Some representatives have in fact proposed that should happen. And Paul Ryan, for example, was a proponent of selling federal lands to the private industry.
Yeah, this land brought to you by insert your company name here, that kind of thing. Interesting. All right, so any real estate agent, obviously, who's worth their weight in gold is going to tell you this is all about location, location, location. Are there areas that are more profitable than others?
Sure. So we see the highest production in two areas, the Bakken region in North Dakota and Montana, and that's pretty much the one that everyone knows about. Less well known is what's going on in New Mexico, where there's an oil boom on the southeast corner of the state. It's in the Permian Basin. It's an oil-rich area that has been producing oil for the past 60 or 70 years. It helped to fuel our efforts in World War II, and it's continuing to fuel.
So this has been going on that long.
Yeah,
this is definitely something flying under the radar until we just talked about BP.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and Jason's really talking about hot areas for federal land.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of when you step back and look at both federal and private, there are other areas. Pennsylvania, which sits atop the Marcellus Shale, lots of oil and gas, or mostly gas in Pennsylvania right now, but development occurring that wouldn't have been there even if you look back a decade. Certainly in a place like California, a lot of opportunity there, but not as much public land. So what we were looking at with our particular report is, where's the opportunity when it comes to federal leasing? There's a whole other universe of opportunity for prospecting, essentially, on private land.
Private land. Are we talking Beverly Hillbillies scenario here, where you've got all of a sudden a bubbling crude coming up out of the backyard?
Yeah, you see some of that, actually.
Really?
If you're a landowner in a place that is suddenly known to be a place with oil-rich or gas-rich deposits, you can make a lot of money. And really that's been brought about by technology, because I think there were a number of areas that had more or less sort of not been written off, but I think the industry had kind of moved away from, and with at least conventional drilling techniques, the idea was there's really not much there. But when you bring in fracking, hydraulic fracturing, as the industry calls it, horizontal drilling, some of these new modern techniques, you really say there's a lot more places that you can drill. So you've got a lot more opportunity to find oil and gas, and you've got a lot of opportunity to make landowners quite wealthy when the situation is right.
You hear lots of stories like Pennsylvania. I've known about the Bakken region. I understood. Now New Mexico was a new one to me. I hadn't quite known that it had been going on that long. I won't say it's new. I knew it was an in existence, obviously. But in Pennsylvania, you hear stories of the water now, as hydraulic fracturing becomes more and more prevalent up in that area. Foul-tasting water, is the water contaminated? What kind of hazards are we dealing with, and are they happening on the government land as well?
Well, I mean, in general, there are a number of studies that are looking at this issue right now. I think the in terms of what we know from a federal standpoint, there's just really a lot of open questions that you raised, and so EPA is really doing a deep dive. They owe the country a report in 2014 that's going to try to answer all of these kind of questions about water and what fracking does for that. I mean, I think there are some isolated anecdotal circumstances where you've had some problems, and so you've seen a lot of folks who are anti-drilling kind of latch onto those. But you also got to keep in mind that this is a practice that's been occurring all over the country, and most of the time safely and without any incident.
Sure. We're speaking with Rob Barnett, energy analyst, and of course Jason Arvelo, economic analyst, both of whom are with Bloomberg Government, talking about their latest piece, Leasing Rebounds, Onshore Production Up. And as we take a look at the overall United States, you can see there's lots of federal land out there. The government owns a lot of land, and there's a lot of fracking and hydraulic fracturing going on. But I can remember taking a cruise out of New Orleans a few years back. And the one thing that I can remember, obviously you can't physically, when you look at the U.S., you could drive around and see these things, but going down the Mississippi River and then out into the Gulf of Mexico, it was astounding the number of drilling operations that are set up out there, these deep water things. I mean, they're literally popping up like mushrooms all over the Gulf. And I remember, like, these things are all over the place. Is it going to be the same in the U.S.? Will we have these giant monstrosity-like eyesores all over federal land now cluttering up what once had been beautiful countryside? or have they managed to cover these things up where you can't really see them?
Sure. Well, it's different infrastructure, as I'm sure Rob will add to this. It's different infrastructure to have offshore than it is onshore.
Sure.
So you're never going to quite see the same structures, but you know, offshore is a very difficult and sophisticated operation, and we see a lot of the big oil players in that area. And, you know, this is the type of equipment that they use worldwide to be able to extract. And, you know, they've done it for decades now, probably over 50 years. So they've really honed down that the best practice in developing that kind of rig structure. And so even though it does look like a monstrosity, you know, it's the best that we have.
Sure. I mean, I never realized. Rob, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, you know, when you're finished with an offshore well, you know, you cap the well and move on, and it's deep underwater, and you don't really see any sign that it was there. Onshore, you know, essentially you can think in you know, long time horizons about, you know, land kind of returning to just being natural. Because, I mean, they're drilling. It's deep underground. There's some disturbance. But once you kind of take all that equipment away, you could imagine a return to something more pristine. It's an industrial process that you're introducing to typically a rural area. So if you look at places that have had all of this development, I think there's just some skepticism because, you know, you're talking about countryside where there's basically been little of anything, and then you have all these trucks coming in, all these people coming in. So those are some of the concerns, but it's also brought a lot of economic activity.
Sure, sure, which is where, you know, the Department of Interior is going, and anybody that's looking at this, EPA would go, well, yeah, the water tastes funny, but let's take a look at the amount of money we're bringing in as a result, looking at the Department of Interior for specifically.
And jobs, too.
If
you were to look at a map of county-level unemployment in the U.S. and then overlay it where economic activity due to oil and gas has occurred, the two pretty well correlate. So that is to say, economic activity due to oil and gas has really contributed just to the jobs issue in the U.S.
By the way, in no way am I saying that the EPA should by any means sweep this under the rug. Obviously, we're due a report. The American people are due a report in 2014, and I'm sure it will be as detailed as humanly possible. Let's take a look at the Department of the Interior. There's been a change. Ken Salazar stepping down, moving on. What does that do for their long-range forecast? I mean, he was the one who really got this ball rolling. What's going to happen next? Jason. Right.
So I think one thing to preface this entire conversation with is the federal government contributes land that we've been talking about that amounts to about 30% of all oil in the U.S., 20% of all natural gas, and 40% of all coal. So when we think of the federal government, we need to think of – when we think of energy development, we also need to think of the federal government. And so inserting anyone new to that position who potentially – could change the direction of federal land development, you know, I think could have a real impact on energy in the U.S.
Yeah, and I think right now it's too early to say who the front runners are in terms of replacing Ken Salazar,
right.
But it's an important role, and it is going to shape the pace more than anything at how quickly we're going to see the government issue new leases and things like that. you know, one of the things that we talked about in the report is that under President Obama's first term, compared with when Bush was in office, we saw a pretty big drop in the amount of activity, leasing activity that was occurring on both onshore and offshore. Now, 2012, we actually saw a pretty big increase, but if you look over the entire 4 years, you know, we saw a market change. And so, you know, we're still going to have President Obama sort of leading the charge, but depending on whether you have someone that is more cautious, you could see a slowdown, or someone who wants to see the resource develop more quickly, you could see potentially a speed up to maybe the kinds of things, levels we saw while Bush was in office.
Obviously, he's going to have a hand in the type of person that's brought into that office. Could his lame duck status, so to speak, play into that at all, where he says, you know what, this is my last term, I'm going to just get as much of this stuff out of here as I can, or, not that important?
Well, I think it's a challenge for President Obama, because on the one hand, I think he's developed a close relationship with a lot of the folks in the environmental community and wants to be seen as a pro-environment president. He mentioned climate change in his inaugural address this week. And so I think that, you know, he is sort of inclined to proceed cautiously. At the same time, he wants to talk about especially natural gas and how it can help make the United States energy independent and things like that. So there's a little bit of a tension there with kind of being cautious because of environmental concern and really wanting to increase energy independence. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that weighs out over the course of the administration.
That's right. And, you know, whoever gets appointed, I think it's important to remember that we're kind of on the cusp of developing solar and wind power on federal lands as well. So while today's discussion is about oil and gas, I think, you know, a few years from now, we could very well be having the same conversation on solar and wind, and who gets appointed is going to be instrumental in having that happen.
I can see in the perfect environmental scenario, the oil and wind powering the drills that are fracking on the sites, gathering the oil and gas. Huh? What do you think?
Possible.
It occurs. I mean, you know, on some of the offshore platforms now, you see solar PV integrated. I mean, I think people are thinking in those terms. It's the all of the above approach, I suppose.
All right. So 113th Congress, now that the inauguration is over and all the celebrations are behind us, what kind of things can we look forward to coming out of them over the next year or so?
I would be very bearish on much of anything coming out of the Congress.
Really?
They're not exactly a body set up to create significant new legislation, as far as I can tell, especially as in the realm of energy. I think we'll see a lot of talk about energy, but probably most action is going to defer to the president. So we'll have a regulatory approach, something that can be controlled by the president, as opposed to a legislative approach on energy coming from the Congress. Or if we did get some new significant energy legislation, I'd be surprised, but there'll probably be conversations about climate change and things like that. But I still think that the ball is going to be in the president's court.
Jason, we've heard from the pessimistic side of the room. How about, what are your thoughts?
The only thing I would add is, first of all, but if we do see any development, it's going to be on the solar and wind front. The federal government right now is designating certain areas that are going to be potential, you know, hot spots for solar and wind power, and we might see some movement on that end in 2013.
All right. Very good. Anything else you guys would like to add? Obviously, both of you on the pessimistic side of the 113th Congress, although I must agree that I think that things will be slow coming out of
that. Well, I mean, I think the things occur in spite of inaction from Congress. I mean, we are witnessing an energy revolution in the U.S. right now in terms of, you know, increased oil and gas production, you know, less reliance on other parts of the world for our energy needs. And that's occurring at the same time, as Jason mentioned, you know, we are having, you know, explosion of new, you know, deployment of renewables and things like that. 2012 was thus far the biggest year for new wind installations in the U.S. Ever. And so, you know, we're doing a lot on oil and gas in this country. The private sector is really driving most of it, but we're doing it on renewables as well. And so we really are seeing an all-of-the-above strategy play out, which is kind of the direction the industry is headed on autopilot, assuming Congress doesn't step in.
Real quick, you know, as I'm sitting here thinking about specifically wind power and solar power, a lot of renewable energy, Europe, by far, way ahead of the U.S. in this world. Why? Why did this happen? How did this happen? We're supposed to be the forerunners in technology and such, and Europe has kind of grabbed the windmill by the horns, so to speak.
I think it does come down to the policy question. And so in most European economies, there are very strong incentives in place that encourage folks to make investments in solar, wind, things like that. We have some incentives here in the U.S., but it's a weaker set of incentives. And, you know, arguably those technologies are still at somewhat of a competitive disadvantage to the to sort of the established fossil fuel industry. And so you've just really seen policymakers in Germany is a great example, really go out and say, we're going to do these things, and we think it's okay to do them, even if it's a little bit more expensive.
The rare earth materials, and here I am going on about this, and I promised myself in my head a minute ago I wouldn't, but the rare earth materials that are required for batteries and such that are going to be used to help continue the generation of this power, are overseas companies getting it cheaper from China than we would?
I mean, there is a lot of concern in the energy sector about the issue of rare earths, but, I mean, there are a lot of chemistries that can be used and a lot of materials, so I think China right now has not a monopoly, but a
pretty close
strong,
to it.
You know, yeah. they've got a lot of the rare earths that are currently used in everything from electronics to
solar panels,
solar cells, yeah, etc. But because China has the sort of the you know, they hold the key on that, I think you're seeing a lot of companies say, well, what other materials can we use? And so you're seeing innovation occur, and my sense is that it hasn't been extremely harmful to the business. I mean, if anything, globally we continue to see a lot of investment in clean energy, both the U.S., Europe, and even in China. So I mean, yes, China has somewhat of a lock on those things, but I think you'll see other countries try to develop resources that they might have there, and you'll see other materials come into the market.
All right. His name is Rob Barnett, energy analyst with Bloomberg Government, joined by Jason Arvelo. Jason, guys, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult, but America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure. Our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks. That is how we will preserve our planet, commanded to our care by God.
Well, that puts the wraps on yet another edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Make sure you follow us on Twitter, @BGov, and you can follow me, @AlanLScott, for show updates. Peter Cook is the man, the myth, the legend, the guy who hosts Capital Gains on WUSA TV9. That's Sundays at 11:30, right after Face the Nation. Check it out, won't you? We'll be back next Thursday at 11 as we have plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, my name is Alan Scott.